This is Chef John Foles welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and inviting you to join us at the kitchen table for another hour of adventures in food. Each week, we travel from the back roads of Louisiana to the streets of Europe's capitals, delving into food. We talk with chefs, food historians, authors, and producers. We'll search out current trends, revive forgotten traditions, and naturally, we're going to try to cook for you. On Cinco de Mayo, we remember the Columbian Exchange, the trade between Mesoamerica and Spain that gave us that great Hispanic culinary tradition. For tortillas, tamales, and tapas, I say muchas gracias, y'all. Join me, Chef John Foles, and Chef Xavier Larentino of Barcelona Tapas in New Orleans as we talk about Hispanic foods on Stirring It Up next. But first, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. In eastern Ukraine, pro-Russian activists have freed the seven European military observers they've been holding hostage in Slavyansk for a week. Meanwhile, Ukrainian forces are carrying out an operation to regain control of key government buildings and TV stations occupied by pro-Russian separatists. And as NPR's Soraya Sahardi-Nelson reports, much of the fighting is concentrated in an industrial city not far from Slavyansk.
Ukrainian officials say they've retaken the state security building and TV transmitter tower in Krematorsk, so Russian TV is no longer being broadcast there. That's important to the Kiev government because they believe the Kremlin is stirring up separatist sentiment, something that Moscow denies. In Krematorsk, Ukrainian troops broke through a barricade of tractor trailers that separatists set up to block the main road into the city. Some of the pro-Russian fighters there include more professional-looking soldiers with automatic weapons. Ukrainian officials accuse the separatists of hiring professional mercenaries. Soraya Sahardi-Nelson, NPR News, Donetsk.
Members of Pope Francis's new commission on sex abuse say they will develop clear and effective protocols to hold church authorities accountable if they fail to report suspected abuse of minors. NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports this was the first meeting of the commission the Pope created last December.
Boston's Archbishop Cardinal Sean O'Malley told reporters moral obligation trumps legal requirements in reporting suspected sex abuse. Briefing reporters at the Vatican, the Cardinal said current church laws could hold bishops accountable if they fail to protect children. But he added that those laws have not been sufficient up to now and new protocols are needed. In their statement, the commission members said it is especially important to emphasize the devastating consequences for victims when suspected abuse is not reported. Marie Collins, a commission member and herself a survivor of sex abuse, said she came away from the inaugural meeting hopeful, primarily because the issue of accountability had been tackled head on. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
GM is recalling more than 50,000 SUVs over a problem with fuel gauges, NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
The problem is with the computer software inside these SUVs. There's a glitch that can make the fuel gauge indicate that there's gas in the tank, even when a car is very low on fuel. The biggest worry is that an engine stalling out unexpectedly could cause an accident. The SUVs include the 2014 Buick Enclave, Chevy Traverse, and GMC Acadia. GM says it will fix the problem by updating the software. The Justice Department is investigating another GM recall. In that case, it took the company more than a decade to address safety concerns about faulty ignition switches. Those could switch cars off and have been linked to at least 13 fatal accidents. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News. In Iran, thousands of hardliners are protesting the country's deal with world powers over its nuclear program. They gathered at the U.S. Embassy in Tehran carrying banners accusing President Hassan Rouhani and the country's nuclear negotiating team of giving up Iran's rights in return for little. That temporary deal was reached last November and saw some sanctions lifted against Iran in exchange for the country limiting uranium enrichment and allowing in international inspectors. This evening at Churchill Downs in Louisville, the Kentucky Derby, the first in horse racing's Triple Crown. Rick Howlett of member station WFPL reports 19 horses are entered in this year's Running of the Roses.
The early favorite is California Chrome, trained by former jockey Art Sherman, who at age 77 could become the oldest trainer to win the Derby. Jockey Rosie Napravnik is also trying to make history. A victory aboard Vickers in Trouble would make Napravnik the first female rider to win the Derby. The original Kentucky Derby field was 20 horses, but there was an early scratch. Opportunity, trained by three-time Derby winner Bob Baffert, was pulled because of a bruised foot. More than 150,000 fans are expected at Churchill Downs for the 140th running of the Derby. For NPR News, I'm Rick Howlett in Louisville.
President Obama is joining journalists, politicians, and Hollywood stars at the White House Correspondent Dinner in Washington, D.C. tonight. The event raises money for education and features a new scholarship this year named for Harry McAlpin, the first African-American reporter to cover a White House press conference. He was denied admission to the Correspondents Association in the 1940s. Comedian Joel McHale is the headliner. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to Stirring It Up, and thank you so much for joining us at the kitchen table today. It's so great to have you, and wow, is the kitchen table filled today. It's going to be a great, great, great day. Across the chair here from me is our executive producer, Michelle Yark. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you, and you?
Good, good. You know, it's been a big week. You know, we announced a restaurant last week.
We announced
a great seafood revolution restaurant in Madison County, Mississippi, which is Ridgeland, right? What, about 14 miles north of Jackson? Is that it?
Yeah, just it's a little bedroom community of Jackson.
Bedroom community. So a seafood revolution. Same architect, by the way, of that beautiful revolution.
That's right.
And, of course, the biggest news of the week, Slama killed the turkey. Absolutely not on the car. And I didn't run over him on the road. I actually, after 4 years of hunting that elusive bird,
I was going to say it took 4 years, but he got him.
The only thing that took longer than killing that turkey was my friend in the boat and old man in the sea.
Okay.
You know what I mean, huh? The old man in the sea. That's the only thing that took longer than that turkey. But I tell you what.
That's
a
journey. 4 years.
4 years. Everywhere. You know, I mean, you only have so many days you can hunt.
That's true.
Be fair now, I don't think you went turkey hunting last year.
No, I didn't.
To be fair that, you know, it wasn't 4 years. Per se.
Right, okay.
Well, every time I went, I'm kind of an aggressive hunter, so I'd go in the blind at 4 in the morning, get out at 11, and I had to go. I had business. And the guides kept saying, you need to spend 2 consecutive days. That's what happened this time. After the big signing in Jackson for the restaurant and the big press conference, the governor was there. That was nice. Mayor Ridgeland, governor had some great words to say. But anyway, we'll be open, by the way, about September the 15th, I heard, if the contractors stay on.
He's been really good. Brent's on track.
Yep. Anyway, so, and then from there, I went to Giles Island, that beautiful 9,000 acres right in the Mississippi River across from Natchez Private Hunting Reserve.
How they doing out there?
Man, they're doing beautiful.
Doing pretty good.
What a beautiful spot. You need to take a boat onto the island, and then you're locked in the middle of the Mississippi River. Right outside, you look across the river, and there's a...
Well, congratulations.
Well, I didn't tell Slime hello yet. We've just been talking. How you doing over there?
Hey, Chef.
Now, you promised. You see, there's a big cleanup deal going on.
That's
here.
That's right. Yeah.
You see, I've been having men in the big studio. I mean, this place has been a mess since the big flood, you know, I'm talking about Noah.
You know, it's been a while.
This place has been a mess. So finally I told David, I said, everything out. I want everything out of this building.
It's got to go. We're going to clean this place.
It's time.
Maybe put a layer of wax down.
Anyway, what else going on, Michelle?
Yeah, how's that book coming along? You know, still
Let me tell you about the book.
Let me tell you about the book.
I'm going to tell you about the book right now. She's going on a cruise. And when she gets back off of that cruise, I will never see her face again in this building until that book's done. She's gone into my libraries. She's gone into my research. She is out of John Falsey Company until October.
When we reconvene on this topic, I will have been on vacation for 3 months.
No.
When you hear it again from John Falls.
I'm just telling you what I have to say. Anyway, Michelle, what else going on?
I tell you, we've been busy. But it's time to celebrate Cinco de Mayo, don't you think? You see my colors today?
Yeah, I know. I see you got that purple.
It's finally summer.
Yeah.
And need to look a little festive, get into the bright colors of summer and the bright colors of Cinco de Mayo. I might go to a Mexican lunch today. You want to come?
No, I don't have time. I got to work. I might take you up on a little lunch. I have to say, while we're talking about Mexican food, I'm thinking about those delicious tamales that we used to have at Pimignoli's. Remember Pimignoli's on Airline Highway in Baton Rouge? Pepper used to make them, and it is sad news. It was a sad day when we found out that Pepper had lost his fight with cancer. And Yoli, his wife, we're still thinking of you and hope you're doing very well. He made some of the best tamales I ever had. For sure, an unconventional man for making tamales.
Because he
was born and reared in Reserve, Louisiana, or down around La Place, and he was a barbecue cook. But, man, could he make tamales. He had some of the best I've ever tasted. We need to take a stop over there and give him a hug, you know.
Yeah.
And y'all, you know, it's interesting that Pepper, as I say, was not Mexican, but, wow, did he have some great recipe for his tamales. And of course, the recipe for these dishes originated, as we are going to talk about more today, from the Mesoamerican people. That's where all of these great foods we call Mexican come from. At Pimignola's, it was his blend of pork and spices that made his tamales so delicious. Just goes to show you how culinary traditions can move and change and be adopted, not only from one culture to another, but assimilated into culture and even individual people's backyard, so to speak.
Absolutely. And tamales are a very old tradition. They date back to around 5,000 B.C. to pre-Columbian history, to the time when the Aztecs and the Mayan and the Incas were at war with each other. Of course, corn and grains were a major food source, but preparation was very time-consuming. Women were taken along to the battles to keep the food supply plentiful and all the soldiers fed. The process for preparing the corn hasn't really changed much today from what it was then. There's a process called nixtamalization. The grain was soaked and cooked in an alkaline solution, usually lime and water.
The ashes from the fire as well.
Right, and then the grain was hulled. And this made it easier to grind, and the nutritional value was increased.
That was the secret, the vitamins, the niacin.
Yeah.
Nobody knew what that was. But
the end product of the processed corn is called masa.
Masa.
And was flavored with spices. Then it was wrapped in the corn husks for easy transport. Simple thing to steam them, grill them over a fire, pack them up for the next battle, and just kind of keep on moving.
And, you know, think about it for a minute. You're taking corn and you're soaking it in lime and ash. Now, I don't know how they figured that out. Maybe the campfire. Maybe they just threw some ashes in. The secret was the niacin that was added to it in this nixtamalization, as you call it. It was really good. Well, tamales continued to be a main staple of the Mesoamerican culinary tradition, and that was brought back to Spain by the Spanish conquistadors. It was also added proof, and needed added proof, that the native peoples were intelligent beings, and they were souls and not savages, as so many thought, just from that process. You know, corn tamales are also made from this nixtamalization process. We all know what a tamale is. It's a flat, round, unleavened disc used to wrap up all of those delicious ingredients. And when you mention the women...
Tortilla.
When you mention just now about the women going out to the war and making the tamales and wrapping them in corn shucks, it just shows you the ingenuity of these people, that they could create something that was movable and easy to carry, easy to cook in on a battlefield. I mean, just think how intelligent these people are. As I said, a traditional method for processing the corn into a tortilla is done without added fats. It's interesting to note here that in the early 20th century in the South, corn was being processed into food, but with the exception of hominy grits, which they did have to soak and lye, and they were not using that nixtamalization process, which adding the lime to create that niacin, that vitamin. Mm-hmm. And there was an epidemic of a disease called pellagra, and it broke out amongst all the poor southern population. And the illness was, of course, the result of a lack of this B3 vitamin. The fact that the early indigenous people of Mexico knew about this vitamin need would be pretty much proof, as I mentioned earlier, about the intelligence of these people, I'd have to say. And, of course, then the South, once they figured it out, the poor people could eat corn, but they could also be healthier.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you remember your Spanish, the tortilla ends in I-L-L-A, tortilla, which translates to little torta.
Little torta.
And a Mexican torta is a mouth-watering sandwich made on a crusty white roll called a bolillo. It looks kind of like a hamburger, except that the bun is flat and unleavened. But inside, it's packed with refried beans and cheese and avocado and jalapeno and grilled steak or maybe chicken or slow-cooked pork. Doesn't that sound delicious?
Oh, and, you know, speaking of culinary contributions brought to Spain, I tell my students all the time that Spain, I mean, forget about it. Of all the seven nations that contributed to Creole, Spain put them right up at the tip of the spear, you know. What they brought to the New World as a food of Hispanic origin that we talk about all the time that actually works in reverse, meaning that the culinary tradition came from the Old World and to the New. That would be tapas.
Tapas, indeed.
Now, tapas has been around for quite a while. In fact, most people might not know it originated in the Philippines. It was a Filipino cuisine that then started to circle the whole world, but it's still considered a relatively new food trend from Spain. This small dish is served with a drink that can be anything from sliced or cured ham or olives, marinated peppers, to prepared foods like eggplant and onion and even stuffed eggs. I love, you know, and I discovered this in Spain, it's called chupitos, and it's a battered fried squid that they serve.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
You don't even know. The servings are, as I mentioned, is small bite-sized pieces, just enough to kind of quiet a hungry stomach before a meal or something, taste it, a munch while you're sipping a sangria or, a wine with friends. You know, it's just, just a little bitty, small, small plate.
You know, tapas bars were the rage for a while, and it seems like the frenzy has kind of died down a little bit, but the popularity of this little snack really has stuck around. This is interesting, I think. The origin of tapas began in the 13th century. And while on a long trip, King Alfonso of Castile stopped to rest in a small town in Spain, ordered a glass of sherry. There was a gusty wind, so the innkeeper served him his glass of sherry covered by a slice of ham, you know, so it wouldn't get dirty.
Right.
It'd be clean. The king apparently liked it, and so when he asked for a second glass, he made sure to say, please serve it in the same way, with the tapa, the cover, or the lid on it. Legend continues that he also ordered that all wine in taverns be served with a bite to eat so that the customer would not get lightheaded.
You know, I stayed in this hotel in Seville.
You think it was his?
Absolutely, right next to the big Palace of Toro, you know, where they did the bullfights on Sunday
morning.
And the big cathedral where Columbus is buried. I stayed right there,
right there.
I'll never forget you.
I can't wait to go.
Anyway, y'all, we're going to take a quick little break. We have a very interesting show today on all these wonderful Spanish little tiny bites and other things that are so important. And we have a great guest, too. I'm really excited about this guest. So when we come back, y'all, we're talking about tapas and tamales and tortas. And
yes, indeed.
Y'all, we'll see you in a minute. Cinco de Mayo in Memphis, mariachi
singing the blues. When you hear us say, listener-supported public radio, what are we really saying? Public radio is shorthand for thought-provoking, well-crafted, stimulating programs. Listener-supported means it's your money that pays for those programs. And not only the programs, but the transmitters, the computers, the electricity, everything it takes to bring you those programs. So here's a very large thank you to you, the listener in listener-supported public radio. If you haven't yet offered your support, please contribute right now at krvs.org.
Oh, you don't need a stamp to enter the world of jazz. I'm DeJama Gagne, the host of Passport to Modern Jazz. Tuesdays at 10 p.m., I'm going to walk you through the gate into the world of current jazz, back to New Orleans jazz earliest recordings, and won't leave out the Hammond B3.
Cinco yemas vi yo tengo para el bautizo de María, con patata la fermento, pero la tapa tan escondida y vida. Ay, dame la tapa, mi negra, pata para la olla, mi amor. Ay, dame la tapa, mi vida, pata para la olla, mi amor. Ay, dame la tapa, mi negra, pata para la olla, mi amor. Ay, dame la tapa.
All right, everybody, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting and cultural show on radio. It's so nice to have all of you with us today, and thanks for joining us at the kitchen table. And of course, Michelle, we're having a great guest on the show today, so you want to, why don't we just jump right into it and talk a little bit about all great things Spanish.
Absolutely. Our guest today is Chef Xavier Laurentino, owner of Barcelona Tapas in New Orleans. Chef Laurentino is actually a native of Barcelona, Spain.
Oh, what a beautiful place.
That is still on my to-do list, so I want to ask him all about it. He grew up there,
yeah,
native.
You had a good Lord spend Sunday there.
So I've heard.
Oh, Barcelona. Go ahead, anyway.
Well, anyway, Chef Laurentino came to New Orleans in 1986 after working as a television actor and a bodyguard. So we definitely want to ask him about that. He intended only to stay for a little while, but like so many people who are charmed by the city, a short stay turns into a longer stay and then into years. And in 1995, Chef Laurentino found himself cooking at his friend's restaurant, Lola's.
Oh, I remember Lola, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm, on Esplanade Avenue. Eventually, he opened his own Spanish restaurant in Metairie and later relocated to the quaint little area at Riverbend on Dublin Street, where he is today. Chef Laurentino and Barcelona Tapas have been credited with introducing New Orleans to the wonderful world of tapas. And boy, are we glad he did. Chef, welcome to Stirring It Up. We're so excited to have you with us today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm really, really happy to be a part of this.
Well, Chef, one of the things I wanted to ask you, Michelle was reading your bio and said, oh, he came as a television actor and bodyguard. We have to know about that. Tell me about that.
Youthful ventures. Well, basically, back in Spain, I work as a bodyguard to make money, and then as an actor to fulfill my soul. Basically, all the jobs I've ever held have something to do with creativity. And that's why I'm a chef today, because I can get in the kitchen and create as well. And so about when I was 27, I decided that I played bodyguard roulette long enough. and I lost a couple of jobs in American movies because I did not speak English. So I decided to come to the States to learn English. The idea was to be here for a year, and I met the wrong woman. I got married, and I never left.
Well, I'm fascinated with your being from Barcelona. Not having been there, tell us a little bit about growing up in Barcelona, the beauty of it, and kind of what influenced you to eventually become a chef.
Well, my influence to become a chef comes from another side, something that a lot of men in Louisiana probably will relate to. As I was growing up, my mom had her own business inside the house. She was a seamstress, and my father owned a factory. And in Spain, you work Monday through Friday, Saturday and Sunday was devoted to family. And so my mom cooked throughout the week, but then Saturday and Sunday was daddy's kitchen day. And he would get all the children in the kitchen, and we would cook for the entire weekend, my dad. And he's the one that actually taught me and all my siblings how to cook and instilled in us the love for creating dishes that are spectacular. And so that's where it comes from, more than anything. My dad used to open books and say, okay, well, let's get a menu for the weekend. And we would look through the whole thing, and then we would go and buy the ingredients, and we would go back to the kitchen and peel them and cut them and chop them and start cooking. And all of this from the time you're three.
Wow, 3 years old. That does.
Yeah. He, I don't know, my dad, he put a knife on your hand and said, okay, peel this. And
Well, it's the same thing here in Louisiana. You do say it's similarities. You're right.
Yes, I have a lot of friends that are old Cajun people, and they say, man, that's how we did it. My dad used to come out on the weekends and create these things, and we would help him, and it was all about cooking on the days off.
Well, you know, Chef, Spain is certainly one of the most important, if not the most important, member of the seven nations that came to settle Louisiana and create the wonderful Creole heritage of this state. As a chef from the other side of the world, from Spain, in Louisiana today, kind of looking, do you see some of the similarities of the Spanish cuisine influencing Louisiana today? Do you see it readily here?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. And in sometimes in funny ways. I remember one time I walked into a soul food restaurant, and I had a soup. And it was in a restaurant on Washington Avenue 27 years back, right when I came to Louisiana. And I had a soup that was a white bean soup. And I looked at I didn't speak English at the time, but the doctor that brought me there, I told him, ask him where this comes from. And they said, well, this is like my grandmother used to do this. And I'm like, man, this is exactly like fabada.
Yeah.
Fabada is a northern Spain white bean soup that's intended to keep people going in the mountains. And since then, I have fabada on my menu, and you have no idea how many Creole people come in and go like, oh my God, this soup is like my grandmother's.
Well, you know, when I think of the beautiful garlic soups, the sopa de ajo, and these beautiful, beautiful soups that have such a heavy influence on Louisiana, and I think to myself how sad it is that people don't relate so many of our foods back to Spain, that is just so, so important in Louisiana cooking. And that's one of the things I love to teach in my culinary school, is just how important Spain is to Louisiana. So I want to thank you personally from the Cajuns and Creoles to the cooks and the people of Spain who came here.
Absolutely. I was thinking today, we have things that are in common. You know, they change basically sometimes based on the availability of things. But, you know, we have our Holy Trinity here. In Spain, we have the same thing. The only thing is that we put garlic everywhere.
Right.
So instead of celery, we use garlic, but it's the same thing, and it's used with the same concept. You start almost anything with a base of aromatics. And when you look at the Creole cuisine and the Cajun cuisine, it's almost the same. You build flavors from the same base.
Like the sofrito.
Exactly. The same thing. The sofrito, I find things here that I'm like, ah, that's a sofrito.
You know, when I traveled to Spain and saw for the first time, you know, I looked in the pot and I see the beautiful colored sweet peppers and the onions and the garlic everywhere. I said, I'm going to sit right here and eat because this is going to be so close to home.
It is. For the longest time, I suspected that paella and our jambalaya were related in one way or another. I always thought these two dishes seem so close. Your technique different, but it's so close as a dish. And then one day, I went to Spain to do a course. I spent 2 weeks in the cuisine of a very well-known three-star in the Michelin Guide restaurant chef in Barcelona. And out of everything he could have asked me, he asked me about the Cajun cuisine. This man, worldwide recognized, he said, hey, what about the Cajun cuisine? And so we talked about it. When I came back to New Orleans, I bought a book by you, the encyclopedia of the Cajun and Creole cuisine.
Right, right.
I wrote a thank you to this chef in Spain, and when I came back to Spain, I gave it to him.
Too kind, chef. I appreciate that, because I have a whole section on Spain in there, because I love
and,
Spain.
And that's why I'm mentioning it, because while I had the book on hand, I read through, and I'm like, oh, my God. And you explain clearly how paella derived into jambalaya by changing the ingredients, availability, you know, all those things that made one thing to the other. It just makes sense. Spanish rice is difficult to get by here, probably 150, 200 years back. And so but we have incredibly good long grain rice. So, you know, one thing after another. And by the time you realize, we have our jambalaya. No. And paella, it is the mama, basically.
No, absolutely, no doubt.
Hey, Chef, talking about culinary traditions and Spanish culinary traditions particularly making their way to the Americas, it seems that the tapas were a little late in getting here, or at least a little late in becoming as popular as they are now. Why do you think they weren't popular here sooner?
I think that tapas has gone through phases in Spain as well. When I was a kid, I'm 55 now, when I was about 10 years old, we lived in, my father moved us from Barcelona to a little village in the northern part of Spain, in the region of Navarra, right next to the region of Rioja, where the wine, Rioja wine comes from. Mm-hmm. And on that region, on Sundays and festive days, the bars would make tapas, and you would buy your glass of wine, and you would buy a little tapa. But before that, tapas kind of died for a while, and then during the 80s, probably, they had this incredible resurgence, 90s, and then it became a worldwide phenomenon because Spain was closed out to the world for 40 years during the dictatorship. The dictatorship went from 1936... to 1976, when the dictator died. After the dictator died, Franco died, Spaniards started traveling. For 40 years, Spaniards didn't go anywhere, basically. We were in Spain, we were okay, we were isolated completely from the world. Look, when I came to the United States, I decided to go to Loyola University here in New Orleans. I was the one and only Spaniard.
Wow, gosh. I didn't realize.
There was one. Now, when you go to Loyola, there's 20, 25, 30, 35 Spaniards, all young people coming to New Orleans, So it doesn't surprise me that tapas didn't come to the United States earlier, because there was no major influence of Spaniards traveling abroad.
Good point. And today, when you talk to the chefs or you talk to the food writers and everybody else, because of the popularity of Jose Andres and all the things that he has done, most people associate tapas with Jose's restaurants instead of the beautiful historic place that tapas holds in Spain.
Yeah, that's also true. I mean, I think that a country like the United States is so massive that once it takes on a concept, whatever the concept is, it Americanizes it. Let's look at Chinese food. You know, what we consider Chinese food is American Chinese food.
Sure, if you take sure.
You take this food to China, they might hit you with something. you understand?
And
it happens with Spanish food, it happens with Italian food, it happens with a lot of other things. It gets Americanized. We develop our own taste for things, and so today in New Orleans, for instance, we have several wonderful tapas restaurants. Most of them offer a variety of tapas. Tapas that have been Americanized, tapas that have French influence, Japanese influence, tapas that have a distinct South American influence to it. I think that my restaurant is probably the one that keeps as close to home as possible, understanding that I don't get all the ingredients that I would like to and all that. And also the influence of New Orleans, it's impossible to not end up putting some andouille someplace.
Right. Well, you know, at the same time, I often think when the chefs come to a place like this, because I know when I travel and I do a restaurant in wherever I am in the world, I'm always looking for things that resembles something I'm comfortable with, and then I start to put it into the food, even though I might be in South America, I might be in London, wherever I am, it doesn't matter. I'm always walking to the market and say, oh, I recognize that. Oh,
yes. That's
now, with regards to the food available to you, and I know you've been in New Orleans a long time now, so you've acclimated so well, but when you walk through the markets, do you have that same sense of, oh, this is what I eat in Spain, this is something that I'm going to add to my dish, while at the same time throwing a little andouille in, I'm sure. Do you find that?
It is. Sometimes I go through the French market just to feel a little bit at home. It's because that's what I'm used to, walking on an open market where the fruits and the vegetables are right there in front of you. You can smell them, you can touch them, and, you know, it brings the a little bit of the home thing. But here we have things like the green peppers, the red peppers that are so staple right now in the north of Spain, and they come from the Americas. You realize that?
Right. Sure, absolutely.
That today Spain considers, we have like hundreds of plates, dishes that have bell pepper, what we call red bell peppers, in them, and they all come from the Americas. Same thing as tomato. Sometimes I talk to people and they tell me, oh, this dish is like 700-800 years old, blah, blah, and I'm like, look, this dish has tomato on it and green peppers on it. And so those were brought in Spain in the 15th century. 500, not 700.
That's right. Came with the Colombian exchange.
Chef,
I want to get some information in about the restaurant. You've been so kind to be with us today. Let me ask you a question. At Barcelona Tapas, first of all, on our website, everybody, we're going to put all of the information on the restaurant because we want you to go and support the restaurant and go eat authentic food at the hands of a chef who's so passionate about what he does. Chef, tell us a little bit about your menu. What can people expect on your menu? Not only evolution, but also traditional.
Well, on our menu, some of the most traditional things in Spain are what we call casseroles. And in English, casserole sounds like, casserole, it means the vessel where it's brought to the table in. It's an small earthen casserole that we cook the things on. And we have garlic shrimp on it. We have garlic chicken on it, garlic chicken Diablo with habanero peppers and serrano peppers. We have Spanish chorizo in sherry wine, which is as traditional as it gets.
Oh, my God, I absolutely love it.
We got a Spanish smoked chorizo link, very thin, in slices, very thin, and we cook it at a high level of fire with the sherry basically flaming it. And it's brought to the table where it's still sizzling, it's still going, it finishes right in front of your nose. And it opens up the senses. That smoked paprika that we're famous for in Spain brings flavors that are incredible. We also, actually, at the restaurant, we have probably the signature dish is paella. And more, even though my restaurant is a tapas destination, more and more we are selling paella. People are beginning to catch on to, oh, we can use a paella as a tapa. You know, they come 5-6 people, they order a paella for one or for two, and they just split it up, and it's like another tapa with an incredible array of flavors.
Chef, I'm going to ask you, do you mind staying on? We're going to take a quick little break, and then I'd like you to stay on so we can talk a little bit more about your menu, because I want to make sure everybody knows that there's authentic Spanish food being done at the hands of a great chef, adopting it to some of the flavors of his new place, New Orleans. If you stay with us, we'll be back in just a minute, okay?
Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
Okay, y'all, don't go anywhere. You don't want to miss the rest of this interview.
I love the corn ones y también de harina. So when my wife calls out from la cocina, there's no tortilla.
During these fund drives, we use the phrase, we need, quite often. The fact is, no matter how much we talk about us, this fund drive is really about you. It's about what you want coming out of your radio when you wake up, when you're in your car, no matter where you are. It's about KRVS being an important part of your life. And because it's important to you, it's important that we share with you what it takes to keep this service going. More than anything, it takes your financial contribution. Many first-time contributors give $35 or $52, but in the end, the amount is up to you. So please call during the day or make your gift now at krvs.org.
Hi, this is Bill Bowens from The Dirty Rice Show, inviting you to join either Mr. Lee Klein, Peter, or myself every Saturday night from 8:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Dirty Rice right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, public radio for Acadiana.
Soy Fernando Pérez Villar. Únanse a mi programa Espacio Latino este domingo a las 5 p.m. para que escuche buena música latina e información sobre la cultura latina aquí en el sur de Luisiana.
That's Espacio Latino, coming up this Sunday evening at 5 here on KRVS.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Online at krvs.org.
Welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting and cultural show on radio. We always love to talk about food and heritage, but we love to talk about the great cultures that created the seven nations that we talk about as the mixtures or the Creolas. And today we have a great example of that with Chef Laurentino of Barcelona Tapas in New Orleans. And what a great interview he has been. And Michelle, I see you have your hand up.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, the only thing that would make this show better today is if we had a little tapas spread here.
Well,
you know, Barcelona tapas. I mean,
I'm sure if we'd asked the chef 2 weeks ago to come into the studio, you'd have a nice look. I have a stove here. I have an oven. We could have had a beautiful paella right here, right now.
I mean, I'm salivating so much here that I almost can't speak.
Chef, somebody's going to get a reprimand. I promise you. Anyway, thank you so much for spending a little bit more time with us, because I love paella, and I love Spanish food.
My pleasure. Actually, Chef, I wanted to put a little seed on your mind. I've been wanting to do something for the longest time, and it would be fantastic if one day we find the right venue to actually do that. I thought that it would be really crazy to cook a paella and a jambalaya side by side and feed the people. I have no idea what kind of venue we could do this, but think about it.
Chef, you know you just opened a dangerous door, you know. because I tell you right now, you and I are going to do that, and we're going to sit down and figure out how to make that, because Michelle and I I'm going to bring the staff, and we're going to come eat with you, but we're going to talk about that in a minute, and we're going to figure that out. Again, you were talking about your menu just now, and you were talking about the paella. Tell us a little bit. I know you probably make different paellas, but tell me a little bit about the paella that you're getting personally when you sit at the table. What do you want to eat in a paella?
The paella that I make at the restaurant, sometimes people come in and say, we don't eat pork, and so we pull the pork out, or we don't eat this. And, you know, you love your customers, and you do the best you can. But the one that I serve is called mixed paella, or paella valenciana, which is probably one of the best examples of a true surf and turf dish, which means that you're cooking seafood and meats together inside the same dish, and the result is a rice that has the flavor of a paella, but then when you eat the chicken, it tastes like chicken, and the seafood still tastes like seafood, and that's quite complicated to achieve. And that's the kind of paella that I make. My paella has shrimp, calamari, mussels, and then it has chicken. That's one of the things that I've added to the paella that I would not have in Spain is andouille sausage or smoked sausage, which I add to the paella, and it brings that homey flavor for the New Orleans native. When they eat a paella, it's like, I kind of know this.
They recognize. Well, you know, many years ago when I was in the region of Valencia, I learned to make a paella at the hands of a chef over there, the way they traditionally made it. And he put the rabbit in the dish, and he put the mussels and the beautiful chorizo and all of these beautiful things in. And, of course, the shrimp and you name it. But it was the combination. And I love that dish so much. When we started my culinary school at Nichols State, what was it, Michelle, 17 years ago?
17, yeah.
We do a class on Spain one day, and I'm going to beg you to come in and Spain in that class. But we do the paella on that class, the Paella Valencia, which I learned so many years ago. I still take that same recipe to the class every single year. When we do Spain. But this year, I'm going to invite you to come and do a paella of your own home and your mother's paella, or your father's paella, I should say. I would love to have that in my school next semester.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime. You can count on me anytime.
Michelle, are you
I'm going to be at class that day.
You're going to be at class that day.
I'll I was just saying.
Chef, what about Spanish wines? My God, Spanish wines. What are you?
Look, it's amazing. When I came to the United States 27 years back, my choices of Spanish wines were only two.
I had two Riojas, actually,
and that was it. And today, the Spanish wine that I have runs like 250. And this wine's coming from regions that I have never heard in my youth. So Spain has gone, it's flourished in the last 30 years like you wouldn't believe.
Oh my.
And it's considered today probably one of the best wines for your buck, basically. When you put quality and price together, Spanish wine's coming really well recommended.
Well, Chef, tell everybody right now exactly where your restaurant is located.
Oh, it's on the River Bend. Basically, if you come down Carrollton Avenue, you are going towards the river.
Right, right.
When you get to Maple Street,
right,
which is one block before the river, you take a right on Maple, and then you take an immediate left on Dublin, and we are right there. There's a Walgreens at the bottom of Carrollton, and we are right behind that Walgreens.
You're not too far from coming down right before you turn on St. Charles. You're not that far away.
I'm one block before you turn onto St. Charles.
Right to the right, there's a couple of famous restaurants in that area as well.
My restaurant goes back to back with Brightson's.
Yeah, I know exactly. Everybody knows exactly where that's at. And y'all, I can tell you also, you can go to his website. Because, and not only that, they got a beautiful picture of him with his white mustache smiling in the restaurant. It's fantastic. Chef, let me tell you, I look so forward to meeting you, and I promise you that Michelle and our crew are going to come, and I'm going to call you in advance, and I'm going to say, have the paella ready. We come into the table, and
yes,
with the white,
sir.
Do you make a garlic soup on your menu?
Yes, I do. Actually, a very, very bare bones. Bare bones, the old style garlic soup.
Somehow I picture your menu on the table that day.
Michelle,
know you're going to want to taste everything.
Michelle, don't be mean.
I'm not being mean. I'm being honest.
Look, Chef, tell me where I went wrong. The chef in Spain told me to put the olive oil in the pot. He told me to slice the garlic very thin and to put about 20 or 30 or 40 heads of thinly sliced garlic and olive oil and cook it slow until the outside of the garlic got a little golden on the edge. Then you take that out and you mash it, and then you put it back in the olive oil with chopped bread that's about a quarter inch in paprika, and you stir all of that around, and then that goes into the stock to create your soup, and then all you do is crack the egg in the cup and pour the soup on top of it, and that's going to be the beautiful garlic soup, simple as that, and the technique has to be followed very, very clearly. And how far off am I on the recipe?
You are right on the money. The only thing I'm not doing at the restaurant is the egg, because some of my customers are like, raw egg, you know. But other than that, it's the exact same thing.
Oh, I tell you, I love it. And that's another dish I teach in the class, every Spanish class we teach the sopanillo as well. Chef, thank you so much.
I want to know about this tapas crawl.
Oh, okay, the tapas crawl is something that I actually convinced 9 restaurants that are one block away from mine. You know, Brightson's was in it, and everybody around us. And what we did is we created an event where you could go to any of those 9 restaurants, and you pay $5, and they would give you a tapa and a small glass of wine, which is about 3 ounces. We bought the same glasses for every restaurant. And you basically did what we do in Spain. You go to one place, you get one tapa, one glass of wine, then you keep on walking, go to the next one, go to the next one. And it was such an incredible success. I had to cancel it at the end because it was very difficult to get all the restaurants to participate, because, you know, we have sometimes on that same day you have a big party and you cannot do both things, etc. So it's a thing that lasted for a few months, and then we sadly had to stop it. But I'm working on something that's going to be similar. I want to do like a tapas festival in front of my restaurant. We have like a little park right in front of my restaurant, big enough for me to bring all the restaurants in the city that do tapas, all the restaurants that have Spanish influence in them,
wow,
one way or another, and do a one-day tapas festival where you can walk from one booth to the next and try tapas. And then at the end of the day, we probably will give you, as a client, we'll give you a paper where you can mark which tapa you like the best, and we'll tally it, and whoever gets the most votes wins, and we're going to give him something that he can take to his restaurant that says Tapa Restaurant Winner of 2014.
Well, Chef, that sounds great. And look, we want to be there to taste them and be part of the judging group walking around. But the thing that I want to do is continue the conversation about you and I doing the paella and the jambalaya cookout.
This is something I've been really thinking for the longest time, and I'm so happy that I had a chance to talk to you guys today, because you are the right people to do that with.
Well, no, hey, look, and I appreciate so much you sending my encyclopedia to Spain. I mean, that was unbelievable.
Yes.
What a great tribute that is. And I promise you, we're going to see you soon. We're going to give you a call and let you know we're coming, because Michelle's got, you see, she made fun just now when I said, I want paella, I want sopanillo, I want the white bean soup.
I was just trying to prepare him, because I know you're going to say one of everything.
Well, what if he comes to the restaurant, if he comes to Revolution, I'm going to put everything that I like on the menu.
I just wanted to give him a heads up.
That's exactly what we chefs do. We want to try everything.
Well, Chef, I hope you let me know if you have an opportunity to get out of your restaurant to come. Normally, I'm at Revolution on Bourbon in Bienville, my new restaurant, every Thursday, Friday, something like that, Saturday. So whenever you want to come and sit down and have a good bowl of gumbo with me, and we can talk, I'd love to have you. Okay?
Yes, sir. As soon as I possibly can.
Okay, good. And thank you so much for being with us today. What a great, great interview you have been, and I know you've charmed our public here, so we appreciate you so, so very much. Okay?
Thank you very much, Jeff, and thank you to everybody who's listening. I'm living my dream in a land of an incredible warmth. Louisiana is the best thing I've ever experienced in the United States. Thank you, guys.
You're a good man. You're a good man. Thank you, Chef. Oh, my God, Michelle, that was a great interview.
Yes, indeed. What a great and warm person.
Well, he had a spirit that's just unbelievable, and I tell you, can't help but love him, right? Chef Larentino, Xavier Larentino from his great restaurant, Barcelona Tapa. I mean, that's really, really great. Mm-hmm. So everybody, look him up and go support him and tell him that you heard him chat right here on Starting Up. Now, what about books on the subject of every week we try to make sure you enhance your library with volumes of great culinary works that are used on our show here.
Well, the first one I want to recommend is Tapas, Sensational Small Plates from Spain.
Right.
It was written by Joyce Goldstein, a good Spanish name.
A good Spanish
Joyce
name.
Goldstein.
That's what I was thinking about.
The author has a restaurant in San Francisco, and in the 80s, she introduced foods from Spain to that area. Now, she admits it was kind of slow to catch on, but now the Spanish foods are a hot item, which she credits to the growing popularity of tapas and easier accessibility to the Mediterranean products, like the olives and the wines and the oils, and of course the Serrano ham. She talks about the regions of Spain, she talks about the foods, the history, gives an education into tapas and what wines to enjoy with them. In addition to all the great recipes, she tells you how to stock your pantry for cooking Spanish style, which I think is a great addition to that little book. The second book I want to recommend, if you want to learn about Hispanic foods of the New World, is Tacos, Tortas, and Tamales, Flavors from the Griddles, Pots, and Streetside Kitchens of Mexico. This was written by Roberto Santibanez. As a confirmed street food lover, this book has my vote. You remember eating on the side, when we were in Chicago, all the little, taco stands in the garage that had been changed into a restaurant?
The old Shell station that had been turned into a restaurant.
That's it. The author talks about the techniques used to make foods like those you'd find in the little cantinas and restaurants of Mexico. Devotes a whole chapter to tamales, savory and sweet, methods for wrapping, methods for steaming. And if you like salsas, you'll find a selection ranging from mild, smoky tomato salsa to spicy chipotle.
Oh, fantastic. And y'all remember us on Facebook, facebook.com. And you can go right there, Stirring, S-T-I-R-R-I-N, Stirring It Up Radio. It's all right there for y'all, the facts and figures, recipes, guests. It's all right there, right? And I'm also going to load up today my Spanish olive tapenade, which is 1.5 cups of Spanish manzanilla olives, a clove or two or three or four of garlic minced, a teaspoon of capers, extra virgin Spanish olive oil. Don't forget, Spanish olive oil, lemon juice, cilantro, black pepper, throw it into a Cuisinart, spin it around. What else you need to do? Just toast the bread, and you have a wonderful Spanish recipe. But I am going to put about 3 or 4 great Spanish recipes on the menu. Y'all go to see Barcelona Tapa Restaurant in River, right on Carrollton Avenue. Great show, y'all. Thank you so much for being with us. Be here next week, and be safe, and hug a Spaniard. Well, they brought us so much good stuff. See you next week.
If you put money into the stock market, you take a chance that your investment may grow. But when you invest in KRVS, you hear your investment grow every day. It pays for stories, programs, and perspectives that add to your understanding of the world, so you grow, too. Consider investing a gift of $10 or $20 a month into KRVS. You'll hear it pay off every time you listen. To make your contribution, please call or go to krvs.org and click on the Support KRVS button. We thank you.
Hi, everyone. This is Pat Mitchell-Worley, co-host of Bill Street Caravan. Join us next week as we get down and dirty with the Oblivions and Bobby Rush. Robert Gordon will continue his discussion on the history of high records. That's all coming up next week on Bill Street Caravan.
Tonight at 11 on KRVS.
A celebration of music of spring this week on Harpistry. Tune in Sunday at midnight and Monday at noon right here on KRVS.
This is KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.